Father, I come before you. I pray for your blessing on our time. Give us wisdom. Fill our hearts with your word. In Christ's name, I pray. Amen. So last week, we were in Genesis 41, which we did not finish. So we'll finish Genesis 41 tonight and then get through as much of Genesis 42 as we can. And so we won't go into all the introduction we dealt with last week, but the book of Genesis is divided. You have a prologue, and then you have five toledot about the origins of the nations, and then you have five toledot about the origins of Israel. And the last of those five is the generations of Jacob. And that's what we find ourselves in. So starting in Genesis 37, in verse 2, we have these are the generations of Jacob, and it deals with the sons of Jacob, primarily Joseph, most prominently, Judah, second most prominently, and also, as we'll see tonight, it deals significantly with the career of Reuben. And the other sons are mentioned along the way, but primarily it deals with Joseph, Judah, and Reuben are the main sons that get interacted with, and of course Jacob is still very much present. So, beginning in chapter 37, you have this story of the sons of Jacob, and the first thing that happens is Joseph is sold into slavery in chapter 37. And then in chapter 38, you have a chapter devoted to Judah's misadventures. And then you have three chapters, so three episodes, that together take up the same amount of time as the story of Judah. So, remember, the original text wasn't divided into chapters, and so you have Joseph sold into slavery, and then you have the story of Judah, what Judah does, and you have the story of Joseph, what Joseph does. And both of them, it's stories of what they do when they're away from their families. So you have the story of Judah's transformation, and then you have the story of Joseph's transformation. And in the story of Joseph, you have three episodes of Joseph on his own. Joseph is in Potiphar's house, Joseph is in prison, and Joseph comes before Pharaoh. And so we find ourselves in the third of those initial three episodes. And then when we dig into chapter 42, we'll find another set of three episodes of Joseph and his family. So Joseph and his brothers the first time, Joseph and his brothers the second time, and Joseph and his whole family the third time. And so you have this pairing of three episodes and then three more episodes. And then we get, by that point, very close to the end of Genesis. And so, where we left off last week, so in chapter 41, if you recall, central to the overall meaning of chapter 41 is the way in which Pharaoh's dream, initially told correctly by the narrator, gets interpreted and reinterpreted and misinterpreted, and finally Joseph is able to get it all sorted out. And so Pharaoh dreams, the butler remembers Joseph, Joseph's brought before Pharaoh, Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams, and he recommends a course of action. And we come to where we left off last week, and that's at verse 38, where Joseph is exalted. But before we dig into the new text, any questions that have arisen to your mind over what we covered last week or what we covered in the introduction up to this point? So anything on chapter 41 up to this point before we plow ahead with new material? See? All right. Chapter 41 and verse 38. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, "Can we find such a one as this is? A man in whom the Spirit of God is." And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "Forasmuch as God hath showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art." If you remember, Joseph said, "It's not in me. God's going to give Pharaoh an answer." So Joseph downplayed his own role, but God rewarded Joseph by Joseph's very downplaying of himself and highlighting of God being what led Pharaoh to recognize Joseph has a connection to God that I don't have, and therefore I need to place him over my kingdom. And so even Joseph's humility served to his advantage. Where were we? For as much as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, And according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from off his hand, and put it upon Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, Bow the knee. And he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. A few things to notice about this. You have in verse 42, Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And so if you recall, Joseph was already shaven, and so he began to look more like an Egyptian. Now the process of transformation is complete. And as we get into chapter 42, we'll see Joseph's brothers don't recognize him. They don't recognize him because he looks like an Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian because he doesn't have a beard, and all of the Hebrews have beards and all of the Egyptians don't. So that's the most prominent physical characteristic. But also, he's wearing a ring, he's wearing fine linen, and he's wearing a golden collar. And these were the symbols of office in Egypt. And because of the archaeological excavations that have taken place in Egypt, we actually have these reliefs on the tombs and the pyramids and other places that show people being invested with high office. And these were the things that would be given to them when they were set in particular positions of considerable power. And as one commentator points out, although English translators have repeatedly rendered this as a chain, Egyptian bas-reliefs show a more elaborate ceremonial ornament made out of twisted gold wire that covered part of the shoulders and upper chest, as well as the neck. And so this is not the normal Hebrew word that's translated as chain. It's not like Joseph had like golden padlocks around his neck, but it's more like a collar. And if you look at Egyptian art, you can see sort of high officials with this sort of like padded collar made out of gold wire that would be sort of woven together. And so that would be what he would wear. And it was a symbol of this very high office that he has. And something else that's really interesting is if you go to the previous, remember I said how that you have these three episodes and the third one usually surprises you by its differences? So what's something that's happened to Joseph twice already? With Joseph's clothing, what's happened twice to Joseph? He wasn't said to have been bound in chains before, but there's something else that someone else said that. Taken. He gets given these garments of high stature. So remember, what did his father give him? His father gave him this coat of many colors, or exactly what it looked like is hard to know, but he gave him this special garment. And what do his brothers do? They tear it up and they dip it in blood. And then he's over the house of Potiphar, and what's Potiphar's wife do to him? She takes his clothes. And so now Joseph is getting a new outfit, and the reader is left wondering, is this going to happen again? And in fact, it doesn't. So we find this pattern. There's like, you get to this sequence of three, and you wonder, okay, is this same thing going to happen again? And it doesn't happen again. So the expectations that have been built by this pattern are subverted, and that helps you, not subverted in like a negative sense, but you're thinking, okay, what's going to happen next? And then it happens, and then something different happens. So we will see this pattern several times. It's just part of the way the story of Joseph is told. So, 41-43, what says in the second chariot that he had, the Hebrew is a little bit tricky. It could also mean, and I think it's more likely, and not that it's a big difference in meaning, but it could also be translated, as some translations have it, the chariot of his second in command. So not just Pharaoh had two chariots and he was in the second one, but it's a specific chariot that belonged to the second in command after Pharaoh. And that, I think, makes a little more sense in context, but it's not a very big difference in meaning. Any questions or comments on that before we move on to the next section? All right. 41:46. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. And in the 7 plenteous years, the earth brought forth by handfuls. And he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. The food of the field, which was gathered round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn as the sand of the sea. And remember, corn is simply in UK English, corn simply means grain. So he's not gathering up ears of corn, he's gathering up grain. So Joseph gathered corn as the sand of the sea, very much until he left numbering, for it was without number. And unto Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God, said he, hath made me to forget all my toil in all my father's house. And the name of the second called he Ephraim, for God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. So we have in Joseph is 30 years old when he stands before Pharaoh. How old was Joseph when he was sold into slavery? He was 17. So he had been a slave for 13 years. That's a long time before he was exalted. And who was someone else that began a public ministry when he was about 30 years of age? Jesus. And Luke 3:23, and Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as it was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli. And so there are some that would see Joseph as a type of Christ. I initially was a little bit, I'm still not completely convinced, because it's not something the New Testament picks up on as much, but this would certainly be one of those things that if you were reading the story that way, you would pick up on for sure. So that would be so if you were looking for ways in which Joseph serves as a type of Christ, this would be one of those that would be, you know, a pointer in that direction. And then in verse 50, so what's the end of Judah's story in chapter 38? What happens at the end? When Tamar's pregnant, what does she give birth to? 2 sons. Judah has 2 sons with a foreign woman. And Joseph has 2 sons with an Egyptian woman. So you have a number of parallels between the story of Judah and the story of Joseph. And this is one of them. In verse 51, it says, "For God said, he hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house." And it was shortly after Joseph forgot the affliction that had come to him in his father's house that he was given the opportunity to save his family from starvation, the very reason he was brought to Egypt in the first place. What are some areas in our own lives in which our refusal to let go of past wrongs threatens to consume our present and future usefulness? So it was when Joseph finally got to the point that he was over what had already happened to him, that he was prepared to save the lives of the very people who had caused it, and in so doing, to carry forward the very plan, reason that God had allowed all of those things to happen to him to begin with. So what would be some areas in our own lives in which our refusal to let go of past wrongs threatens to consume our present and future usefulness? Brother Russell? Pardon? Yeah. Harboring bitterness towards others. Yeah. It's like one old preacher said that I heard someone said that someone said and repeated, but it's the bitterness is like drinking poison and waiting for your enemy to die. And that, I think, really is profound. It's so destructive. It doesn't harm those you're bitter against. It only harms you. Mm-hmm. It gives them more control. Even if they acted in a violent and dreadful way to you, refusing to being even willing to forgive, even if reconciliation isn't possible, that holding on to that hurt will destroy your life more than anything they could have possibly done to you, however dreadful that actually was. And people can do dreadful things that are extremely hurtful, but if you hang on to that, you're giving them a power that they couldn't ever take, no matter how much stronger they were than you. Anyone else? Yeah, that's so often in our generation, people end up, they're so mad about something that could be very serious or could be relatively trivial. And it really doesn't matter because it still shapes the entirety of the rest of their lives. And it's basically, even if it was as bad as you think it is, don't let it shape your life. Precisely because it may have been as bad as you feel that it was. Don't let it shape everything about you. Because you're giving it a destructive power that in and of itself, nothing that can happen to you actually has. I think one of the ways this can happen where those two things tie together is when we're put down in some way by someone, particularly by parents or by someone that we wanted to respect us, and they didn't give us the respect that we wanted. And people can spend their entire lives trying to vindicate themselves in the eyes of someone who may not even still be alive, or who may be completely unwilling to ever recognize what you're doing. And yet you can still give them total control over your life, where every decision that you make, this is the time I'm going to prove myself to that person. This is the time that finally I'm going to make what they said about me be not true. And they may not care, and they may not even be alive. And yet you've given them total control over your life. This happens so often that every time you make a decision, you think of, Now I'm going to prove that what they said wasn't true about me. And you have to get over that to be able to do what God has for you to do, because if you don't, you're limiting how God could use you. Yep. That's very good. Well, let's move on with verse 53. Thank you all for that. That's very good discussion. Verse 53. And the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended. And the 7 years of dearth began to come, and so now Joseph's been gone from home for 20 years. And the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said, and the dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go unto Joseph, and what he saith to you do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians, and the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt. And all the countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because that the famine was so sore in all lands. And something that's interesting is normally famine in Canaan was caused by lack of rain, and famine in Egypt was caused by a lowering of the Nile, which would be something that took place actually wherever the sources of the Nile are. I think they're in Ethiopia, or maybe they're south of Egypt. And so normally you wouldn't have a famine in Egypt at the same time as you had famine in Canaan, because they were caused normally by two different things. So the fact that there's famine in Canaan and famine in Egypt, there's a couple possible explanations. One is that supernaturally the two coincided, even though they almost never did. So there was two separate famines that were caused by separate things that in God's providence coincided. That's one possibility. The other is that there was some insect infestation. There was some other cause of the famine other than simply the normal failure of the Nile, which very rarely happened but did on occasion, or failure of rain in Canaan. So it's very unusual. This is not normal, that there is famine in Canaan and famine in Egypt at the same time. Normally, when there was famine in Canaan, there wouldn't be famine in Egypt, which is why the patriarchs were always going down to Egypt during a time of famine, because they're part of separate ecosystems. So we don't know exactly why, but we do know the text tells us that the famine was in both Canaan and Egypt. And so now we come to chapter 42. And this is the first of three journeys into Egypt. So you have the first journey by 10 of Joseph's brothers. the second journey that includes 11 of Joseph's brothers, and the third journey, which includes the whole family. And so you have this same question. Joseph tests them the first time. Joseph tests them the second time. So you're left asking the question when they come the third time, is there going to be another trip? Are there going to be more tests? And in fact, there's not. So you have this, it's loose. It's not like this lockstep thing, but you have this sort of pattern of expectation. Then it happens again, and then it happens differently. And in fact, they stay in Egypt, and they're not tested again after. So they're Joseph's brothers. At the end of the story, they're concerned. If Joseph has tested them on their first two trips, then you can see why they would be concerned that Joseph might want to do something to them after their father dies, because this is the pattern that he set of putting them through the ringer, as it were. So they're understandably worried, now that Dad's out of the way, maybe he'll put us through the ringer some more, but he doesn't. So in this chapter, in chapter 42 itself, you have this sort of ring structure. So you have, at the beginning, the very first verse, you have Jacob speaking to his sons. Then you have Jacob's sons journeying to Egypt. Then in the center, you have Joseph's brothers meeting with Joseph. You have interview one, and the brothers are imprisoned. Then you have interview two, and Simeon is imprisoned. Then you have a journey back to Canaan, and then you have a second conversation with Jacob. So this is what is known, if you love long technical terms, this is what's known as a palistrophic structure, or also a chiastic structure. These are terms that are used in literary studies. If you don't love long terms, don't worry about it at all. Just know there's this, I like the term sort of ring composition, that it ends where it starts. And this is very, very common in the Old Testament, that you have the beginning and the end of something look very similar. And so you'll have episode A, B, C, C, B, A, like that. And that's the way the chapter is structured. And so let's dig in verse 1. Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, why do you look one upon another? And he said, behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die. And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt, but Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him. If you look at verse 3, so you find Jacob is speaking to his sons. So Jacob said unto his sons in verse 1, and then in verse 3, you have Joseph's 10 brothers going down to buy grain in Egypt. And this serves to remind us of the way Joseph is related to his brothers. So you'd expect, if Jacob's speaking to his sons, that the text would say 10 of Jacob's sons went down to Egypt. But in fact, it says 10 of Jacob's brothers. And this is one of the sort of subtle narrative clues that you have in Hebrew narrative, that the way that people are named and described is almost always significant. We don't always know what that significance is, but very often it's pretty obvious that by mentioning Joseph in connection with his brothers, it's cluing you in, even before you get further on in the story, that this connects to what's just happened to Joseph. This is not the start of a brand new story. This is the start of a new chapter in the same story about that's dealing with Joseph that's already been being told. So that's significant. And then you have in verse 4, Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin with his brethren. Now, Benjamin by this point already has children. He's not a little kid. He's an adult. But Jacob is concerned that Benjamin not go with them. Why might he be worried about sending Benjamin on a journey? Who else died on a journey besides Joseph? That was very precious to Jacob. Rachel, in Genesis 35:16, and they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and Rachel dies in childbirth. So Rachel dies on a journey. Joseph is sent on a journey, and Jacob is convinced that Joseph is dead. So he didn't want the same thing to happen to Benjamin. He's seen too many accidental deaths in the family that he cares about. So his trepidation is understandable. Any questions or comments about that before we move on? Yes?
Why
Yes. Yeah, it's very clear in Genesis 34 that he really doesn't care what happens to Leah's children. He only cares about Rachel and her children, and this is going to be even more clear as we work through the rest of the story. Anyone else? Brother Russell. Yeah, I think the word is actually, it's very interesting because it only appears in this. So the word ason, which is the Hebrew word there, it only appears in this story three times and in two other passages in Exodus. And in those other, one in Exodus, I think one in some other place in the Pentateuch. So it only appears five times total. And the other places, it refers to something that seems to be a miscarriage. And so it does, like, when we think of the word, so it's a word that's really, there's actually like several articles, I have not read all the articles that have been written about it, but it's a really tricky word to define because it only appears in those five times. So there's some debate about what it means, but I think the closest to a consensus that I could find on that is that it means something like a accident that nobody can be blamed for, or like something, it has some nuance of something bad that happened that's in some way accidental, that wasn't necessarily intended. Because remember, he thinks Joseph died by a happenstance and Rachel dies by happenstance. So I think that word isn't used to talk about the death of Rachel, but I think from Jacob's perspective here, he might be tying them together. We'll see when he gets to the end, he has actually a different view of Joseph's death. There's something really shocking that I never noticed before if we get to the end of chapter 42 that I read about while I was studying for this. That's really interesting. We'll get to that when we get there. But I think it does have some sort of, it's hard to be sure because it's one of those words that if you only have five uses of a word and three of them are talking about the same thing, it's really hard to know exactly what it means. But I think that's what the general consensus is. Anyone else on these first few verses before we move forward? All right. Verse 5, their first interview with Joseph. A little bit longer section of text, but let's read the whole paragraph before we move forward. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, Whence come ye? And they said, From the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, Ye are spies. To see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said unto him, Nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said, Thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. And Joseph said unto them, That is it that I said, spake unto you, saying, Ye are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your word may be proved, whether there be any truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And he put them all together in ward for 3 days. So if the 10 brothers of Joseph hinted at the connection of what was about to happen to Joseph, what would you think the potential implications of the sons of Israel going down to Egypt might be? Anyone have any ideas on that point? Why would it speak of the sons of Israel? I think what this hints at is the connection between the nation and what is taking place here. So if you remember, these words are addressed, as best as we can tell, to the nation of Israel. And the consistent way, so when you see the children of Israel in Hebrew, that's always the sons of Israel. So it's this same phrase that you have here. And so the fact that they're described as the sons of Israel, as one commentator put it, is a hint that the journey to Egypt, this journey to Egypt, has national import. So this is significant for the future of the nation. And again, sometimes it's debatable how much should you read into these little details, but when you have consistent patterns that emerge, it's normally worthwhile paying attention to them. And then you have in verse 6, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. Now, as I mentioned, when I had in the notes that we distributed when we were doing this in our neighborhood fellowships several weeks ago, there's some really odd ambiguities about the second dream. And the first dream, it's clear the first dream is fulfilled. It's not completely clear that the second dream is fulfilled. And there are also some oddities that it almost seems to exalt Joseph to a divine position. And so there's some who would interpret the second dream as Joseph's pride is getting the better of him and he's going beyond what God actually revealed and God humbles him. So there's some who would read the second dream that way and say the reason it's not clearly fulfilled is because it was actually the result of Joseph's pride. So that'd be one way of reading it. The other way of reading it is to look in the text for hints that actually elements of both dreams are fulfilled and so not maybe be so caught up on the details of fulfillment. So if you are looking for hints of the fulfillment of both dreams, one of them, so there's a lot of ambiguities. One of the things that's interesting about the story of Joseph is the way in which there's ambiguities that cause you to really wrestle with the text and think through what's actually going on here. And sometimes that wrestling is itself the point. It's not always resolved for us. But if you try to push against a rock that's bigger than you can move, and you will get stronger even if you don't ultimately move the rock to where you want it to go. And that's something that Scripture often does with many things. And I think it's one of the things that takes place with some elements of the story of Joseph. But if you're looking for hints of the fulfillment of both dreams, one that's quite interesting is that here Joseph is given a double description. So if you remember, in his two dreams, he's the sheaf to which the other sheaves bow down, and then he's the one to whom the sun, moon, and stars bow down. So if you are looking for hints of the fulfillment of both dreams, he's the provider of food, and he's the leader of the land. So he's the one to whom he is. So one would be a governmental. So you could interpret one dream as being in some way referring to a governmental office and one to referring as providing food. So personally, I'm not completely convinced of that. But the double identification of governor and provider and a celestial dream and a food dream, that might be a possible connection. So I'm not sure about that, but I thought it was worth pointing out. Joseph's brethren come and bow down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And this is clearly the fulfillment of his first dream. And as I mentioned before, there's a bit of ambiguity about the fulfillment of the second dream, and we don't have the time to explore all of those details tonight. In verse 42:7, you have this, and he knew them. And this word that's translated here as "and he knew them" is a Hebrew word which means to recognize. And it's the same word that we find in 37:32. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "This have we found, know now whether it be thy son's coat or not." And it shows up in 38 when Judah is asked to recognize the signs that he's given to Tamar. So Tamar shows the signs, the token, the rod and the seals that Judah had given to her. And she says, "Recognize who these belong to." So that shows up in chapter 38. And this actually, where it's translated as discern, and this same word goes back to 27:23, where Jacob's own father didn't recognize him when he deceived him. So you have in 27:23, "and he discerned him not," that's the same word, because his hands were hairy as his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him. And the only other passage where this word occurs, so you might think, well, this could just be a very common word that shows up all over the place, so it's no wonder it shows up in these stories. That actually is not the case. There's only one other story besides the ones I just mentioned where it occurs in Genesis, and that is in Laban's search for his gods, so he doesn't find his gods, and it uses that same word. All of these stories are linked together, and it's a chain of cause and effect Jacob wants his father to recognize him falsely as Esau, and Jacob deceives his father, and then Judah is deceived, and then, So first Jacob deceives his father, and then Jacob is in turn deceived by his sons, and then Judah, who had led in the deception, is in turn deceived himself. And now all of the brothers who had deceived their father are not recognizing. So you have this lack of recognition. So it's a tie. It's one of a number of words, and I won't go into all the details and all the word plays, but one of the things that takes place in Genesis is these key stories are linked together by the repetition of vocabulary. So it's a key part of the way the stories are written, that there's vocabulary, there's word forms, there's grammatical structures, there's all of these things that serve to link the stories together and serve to get us to read one story in light of the stories that have preceded it. And we've talked about many of these elements in these previous stories, and this is one of them. And there's many word plays between 37 chapter 37 and chapter 38 that link to chapter 42, and it helps us to see that Joseph's brothers are going back through their previous experiences, and they're being caused to relive what they had done to Joseph. Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him because, as we already talked about earlier, he looks like an Egyptian. In verse 9, Joseph remembers the dreams which he had dreamed of them. And why did Joseph need to remember? We just talked about this a few minutes ago. Why did Joseph need to remember his dreams? Yeah, but why did he need to remember them? What does the text say that he did to his father's house and what had taken place to him there? He forgot about it, so he had to remember it. So this tells us he had to remember it, so he forgot about it, therefore he remembered it. In the second part of verse 9, there's something that's very interesting here. He accuses them of coming to see the nakedness of the land. And Joseph's brothers had once stripped him of his garment. So this was something they had done before. If his garment was stripped, Joseph was left naked. So it's not necessarily completely off that Joseph accuses them of being people who spy out nakedness. So there's a deep level connection between what had happened to Joseph and what he accuses them of wanting to do to Egypt. So he can't bring up that story because they don't know who he is, but he actually accuses them of doing what they in fact did to him, to the nation of which he was now the representative. And of course, that's at one level of the story, at the story of Joseph and his brothers. At the level of Joseph's brothers and what's taking place at that present time, Egypt would have been potentially more vulnerable because of a famine, and so they might be spying out as representatives of invaders who could take advantage of Egypt and try to take it over. So that's what the Egyptians would have heard, but if you try to dig into why would Joseph make that particular accusation, we can't be certain of that, but it seems possible. Why do you think that, so in verse 11, it says, we are all one man's sons. So Joseph accuses them of being spies, and their response is that, hey, we're all brothers. Why do you think they would give that as a response to the accusation of being spies? Does anyone have any ideas? Exactly. Something else. That's one element, because you know the spies from the 12 tribes were representatives from the different tribes. But there's one other. That's, I think, part of it. There's one other thing that's another possibility that's sort of connected to that. Any other ideas? Well, I think the two things is that, as one commentator put it, we're one family unit and would not jeopardize the lives of all of us by collectively engaging in such a dangerous occupation. So I think that's one element. And the other element is, if they actually are the representatives of an invader, then someone who's planning an invasion isn't going to trust their whole spying apparatus to one group of brothers. They're going to want representatives of all the invading armies to come. But it's so one of those, I think, are two possibilities. But they seem to be very convinced that this is a convincing refutation because they keep repeating this over and over again. So exactly why they thought this was a good counter-argument, we can only speculate. But evidently they thought it was a really good one because it's the only one they make, and they make it over and over and over again. Anyone else? Yeah. Yeah, they weren't very sharp. Yeah, one of the other interesting things is Jacob is going blind. So we know that later on that Jacob's eyes are set a few chapters later. So Jacob can't see very well, but Jacob is the one who sees that there's grain in Egypt and says, why are you seeing at one another? You're standing around looking at one another. So Jacob can see clearly what needs to be done while his sons can only see one another and their own haplessness. So there's a little bit of poking fun of Joseph's brothers as we work through this story. 42:13, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. Notice that they leave Joseph for last. And there's this neat tendency in the narrative of Genesis that often when people are speaking or events are being described, the most sensitive, hardest to say detail will be left for the last, even if it violates historical order or grammatical coherency. So you have this when Abraham hands over Ishmael to Hagar. It's like the grammatical order is all jumbled so that Ishmael can be the very last thing that's mentioned being handed over. And we'll actually find that the order in which Joseph and Benjamin are described is reversed between what they tell Joseph and what they're going to tell Jacob at the end. Because for them, the most sensitive, hardest thing to say was the death of Joseph because they were responsible. So they leave that for last. But for Jacob, when they get to Jacob and they're sort of nuancing their speech for Jacob, they say Joseph first and they mention Benjamin last because Benjamin is now his pride and joy, and they mention him at the last possible moment. Verse 15, hereby ye shall be proved. And the Hebrew word that's translated as proved is primarily used in metalworking context. Another verse it appears in is, for thou, O God, hast proved us, thou hast tried us, as silver is tried. As one commentator pointed out, the word translated as proved means to test in the sense of determining or finding out the value of something, which is, of course, exactly what Joseph is doing. What do you think Joseph's motivation was in accusing his brothers of being spies? Yeah. Well, I think let's ask the broader question. Why does Joseph test his brothers at all? Why does he make accusations? Even apart from the specific accusations, why is he treating his brothers roughly? That's a key part of it. So there's a number of elements. I think, really, I'll just take a few and then we'll talk about it. So Benjamin's not there. Anyone else? Yeah, he's going to test them. So I think there's probably a lot of things going on. However much Joseph may have forgotten about them, if he's being exposed to them again, his emotions have got to be going completely crazy. And you see Joseph does some pretty odd things. It's very unlikely that he has this whole plan planned out from the beginning. It's quite possible, at least if you're just hearing this and you know what Joseph's brothers have done and you don't know the end of the story, I think a lot of readers would have been wondering, is Joseph trying to get revenge? Because he says he's going to test them, but we don't actually know what Joseph's going to do. And I think it probably is the case that Joseph doesn't know what he's going to do. We do see this one tension, and that is Joseph is desperate to find out what's happened to Benjamin, and Jacob is desperate to not allow Benjamin to go. So this is the tension that's driving the story, is Joseph is determined, I'm going to get Benjamin here and find out if he's okay, and Jacob is determined, Benjamin is staying with me so that he stays okay. And you have this, they don't know, Jacob doesn't know that Joseph is alive, and Joseph isn't sure that Jacob is alive or Benjamin is alive, but you see this tug of war that's taking place between Joseph and Jacob about Benjamin. So certainly a big factor is he doesn't know what's happened to Benjamin. Another factor may be he's testing them to see if their characters have changed. He may still be wrestling with the temptation to take revenge on his brothers. Almost certainly, he's not some superhuman angel. He's got to be tempted to take it out on his brothers. And yet, in the end, he doesn't do that. But surely his emotions are pretty mixed. Yeah, that's possible. I haven't thought about that. But he uses deception. Whatever he does, he certainly is being deceptive. Brother Tanaka? Yeah, and so should we take Joseph's deception as permissive? That this is an example of what we should do? Not necessarily. And I think the reason is, you know, you could say, well, if you marry sisters, then one of your children will turn out to be a Joseph. That doesn't necessarily follow, right? Because this is actually something that's explicitly forbidden later in the Pentateuch. You shouldn't marry sisters. And there's lots of other evidence that the marriage of Leah and Rachel didn't end up... Leah and Rachel. Right. That marrying Leah and Rachel did not lead to a happy family. But one of the things that people have had a tendency to do is, well, this, they did this and it turned out all right for them, so therefore I can do this. But these stories are not primarily given to us to provide guidelines for our behavior. They certainly give examples and illustrations of how God preserved his people, and they serve as examples to us, but those examples are not always unambiguously positive. And so, you know, it's like, if you're going to take that as an example, you need to realize that you could also take something ridiculous as an example with equal validity. And so if you're taking that as your justification, then really you could justify all kinds of bizarre things that way. And so what's actually your justification is that you're just doing what you want to do, regardless of what the text actually says. So I don't think that we're intended to take this as, here's how you deal with difficult family members. But, which I have heard some people suggest, believe it or not. Because if you want to say that, then, you know, if you want to say, how do you get a son like Joseph? Well, you marry two sisters that hate each other so much that they get sold into slavery, and you'll have this wonderful son named Joseph. That's not necessarily going to happen. And in the same way, if you deceive your family, it's not necessarily going to end up like it ended up for Joseph, because this is something that God was providentially guiding. Yeah, well, because so Joseph's 17, so his youngest brother is very young, but he's his only full-blooded brother. And he knew about the conflict between the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel. And so he's very concerned what might have happened. So he doesn't know Benjamin. It's not like he was close to Benjamin, because this is 20 years later. But Benjamin was born before he had gone. So he knew about Benjamin. But he was wondering, did they do the same thing to Benjamin that they did to me? Is he even still alive? Right. Yeah, so he's his only full-blooded brother. And given the level of conflict in the family in the past, he's understandably concerned about what might have happened in the future. So it's important to remember that the narratives in Genesis are descriptive rather than prescriptive. The hero is God, not Joseph. Let's see. Can we dig into the second interview with Joseph? Maybe. Any other questions about what we've covered up to this point? Brother Tanaka? Yeah, that's certainly possible as well. That there's, you know, and some of it is really we don't know, and I think it's quite possible that Joseph didn't know exactly. I mean, you can imagine the turmoil he's in. He's thinking, like you said, about his dreams. I think that's a part of it that he's trying to fulfill, and this goes into how should we read those two dreams, because there's not a clear account of Jacob, Joseph's father, ever bowing down to him. And, of course, Joseph's mother is already dead, and so she doesn't bow down to him. So there does is Joseph trying to manipulate things to get both of his dreams to be fulfilled? Or is he trying to be faithful to the revelation that God has given him? Well, we don't know, And maybe Joseph didn't know. I mean, if you think about our own motivations, whenever something momentous happens, they're usually pretty conflicted. And we can't always even sort out our own emotions when something difficult is happening. And so I suspect Joseph probably couldn't sort out his either. But it's interesting to think about the different elements that might have gone into that. And I think it helps us to realize how applicable this is in our own lives, that, you know, sometimes our lives get messy and confusing as well. And it's not always just this simple, you know, sort of distinct from real life sort of thing that's taking place. Yeah, there's been a little bit of, so I read a few different views on that. It's like, it may be a polite way of saying he's dead, or it may be we don't know what happened to him. So it's as ambiguous in Hebrew as it sounds in English. It's sort of an odd thing to say. It's not, and he's dead. It's, and he's gone. He's not. Like, that's a very literal translation. And so it is sort of an odd way of describing it. And in fact, it's the same way that Jacob is going to use at the end to say Joseph is not. He doesn't know what happened to him. So it sort of leaves this, it's this nebulous sort of way of describing it. Like if you said, like, you know, Joe isn't around anymore. Well, what's that mean? Is that a really polite way of saying that he's dead? And I'm not thinking of any particular person named Joe. Does it mean he moved somewhere else? So it's really this sort of nebulous, cloudy way of describing it. So that's a good observation. Exactly. They wouldn't want to admit what they did to him. And that's one of the things that just hangs over this whole narrative as they're going through this. They don't want to admit what they've already done. And we're not going to get to the end of 42 tonight, but when we do, we'll find there's some very interesting things that are said there. Brother Russell? Yeah, you wonder if they talked about that. They probably didn't think that, but yeah, realistically, given what happened to slaves in the ancient Near East, they probably assumed that he was dead. You know, given it had been 20 years, and given how, but, right, they didn't know. You know, so they he was gone, he disappeared, we don't know. And this, I wish we had time to get to, we'll get to the end of chapter 42, because there's this fascinating interchange that takes place between them and their father at the end. So you have to come back next week for that. Yes, next week, what's today's date? This is the 9th. Okay, so next week we will be back in Genesis. Yes, we will be. Yes, so we will dig into the end of 42 next week. Any other questions or comments in the few minutes we have left? This is good discussion. This is so much fun. At least I'm having fun. Hopefully, at least some of you are as well. Anyone else before we conclude? Going once, going twice, going 3 times. All right, well, we don't have time to read through the next section, and there's only 5 minutes till it's time to pick up the kids. So we'll go ahead and pray and be dismissed. Father, I thank you for this time in your word. I pray you'd fill us with your spirit. Give us wisdom and insight. Help us to glorify you in everything that we do. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.